Paul and Jordana, Dan Cook producing today. Great to have Dan back with us. Long lost friend.
It's great for us. Maybe not so great for Dan.
Yeah. He's still smiling through gritted teeth. Yeah.
Stuck with us, though, for the rest of the week. So that smile better get plastered on his face because it's going to be gritted teeth by the end of the week.
So, Jor, I'm a bit of an early adopter. When new tech comes out, I tend to be one of the first in line. But today, Apple released the new iPhone 12.
Ooh.
And I'm happy with my 11. It's been good. It's been a great phone. But I see no overwhelming urge to upgrade this year. Next year, who knows? But the big claim to fame this year is 5G. Much faster bandwidth. You know, faster upload times and download times. Higher quality video streaming they're touting on the Apple website. More responsive gaming. Real-time interactivity in apps. FaceTime now in high definition, okay? Not sure I want that. And much more.
Oy.
But I'm sure the camera's incrementally better. Other things are incrementally better. But I'm going to resist the urge to upgrade this year. I mean, everybody does what's right for them. But every couple of years, I upgrade. But I don't think there are apps that take full advantage of 5G. So to me, it's a little premature. And I know Verizon and AT&T touting their 5G networks, but I don't know. What do you have? You have one of the old Razer flip phones still. How's that working?
Hey, stop judging. It was a StarTAC and it was a flip phone.
And it still works.
An antenna. And it was fantastic. It was my first cell phone. It didn't even have a screen. Like, there was no ability to text or anything like that. But do you remember that? The StarTAC flip phone?
Oh, I remember.
It was really small. It was black, and obviously it folded down. You had to put the antenna down. It was, like, very Star Trek.
And now we look back and chuckle at what we had in our pockets and our purses. And 5 years, 10 years from now, we're going to look back at this time and go, oh, can you believe, that passed for a phone. I mean, we're on such a steep learning curve.
Right.
The built-in obsolescence. And I mean, I had a drawer full of old flip phones. A drawer.
Yep.
And I'm just trying to resist that gravitational tug to have the latest shiny object. Guys like shiny objects, but
yeah, I get that.
I'm going to resist.
Keep those phones, though. They should either go in a museum or they will be worth something someday because they are relics and it's fun to see. I remember when those phones were around, the trend was the smaller the phone. The phones were getting smaller and smaller and smaller because, you know, it's convenient. You could put it in your pocket. Like my dad, you could clip it to your belt. You could do whatever you wanted. But then, of course, then we got the screens and then the phone's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And my phone, I have a Max because, I like a big screen. You know, and I have a pocketbook that I could put it in. It's not like I have to keep it in my pocket. So I like.
But don't you miss calls?
So my phone's huge.
My wife never picks up. I can never reach my wife. I can never reach Lori because she has the same thing. She doesn't keep it in her back pocket.
It's in her
purse.
So you don't even feel it vibrating.
That's by design, right?
Yeah, we don't really want to talk to you guys that much.
Could miss my calls, yeah. Okay, I get it.
That's right. We're not missing much. We're good. Yeah. So listen to this. Have you ever heard that as couples grow older together, they start to look like each other?
I thought couples look like their dogs. I thought people start to look like their dogs, but they start to look like each other? Really?
That's that too. But apparently this question has intrigued psychologists for years. I believe there was a study in the 80s that started to look at whether or not couples grow to look like each other. Well, now researchers at Stanford University have thrown modern technology at the problem, and they've analyzed thousands of public photos of couples, and they believe they have settled the matter. In fact, couples do change to look more like each other over time.
Really?
And it's not really about face structure, like things like that are not changing. But what they found was, the reason for it was diet, lifestyle. They even say laughter lines all have a part to play. You know, if you guys are traveling to warm climates all the time, and maybe you're not wearing sunscreen, you're both becoming more wrinkled and your skin is getting more damaged. If you're eating the same diet, you know, you're cooking the same meals over time, your outward appearance reflects your diet. And then if you are laughing all the time, you have more laugh lines. So they're saying it's more of it's what your face becomes and how you age together. So you have the same, which I thought was really interesting. But the study also found this, that celebrity couples don't necessarily grow to look more alike over time, but they notice that celebrities are attracted to people who look like themselves. Like, oh, for example, no. Benedict Cumberbatch and Sophie Hunter. I didn't know who she was. I had to look it up. But think, you know, Gisele Bündchen and Tom Brady. I mean, they could do the brother-sister thing. They're both very beautiful, and they look like each other. And with celebrities, they say they kind of went for partners that had similar features to themselves. I don't know if that speaks to their narcissism or that they are just beautiful people and they're attracted to other beautiful people. But the matter has been settled. We tend to look like each other and maybe our dogs over time, but also beauty attracts beauty. So I know it was a burning question for you, and I'm glad to bring you this breaking news.
That's troubling research. I do know, though, Lori has gotten a haircut just like mine, just to make me feel a little better about my hair.
God bless that woman. God,
yeah, she's her. A saint. All
she
right.
She is definitely a saint.
When we come back, Stephen Belton, President, CEO of the Urban League Twin Cities. Do we have a problem with racial inequity in this nation? There seems to be some confusion, at least with the administration. That's coming up.
Welcome back. 419, Jordana and Paul. Dan Cook at the helm, thank you for spending some time with us on this gorgeous Tuesday afternoon. I hope you got some time to get outside because it is spectacular. What is happening in some parts of our country, not so spectacular. For example, an executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping is being very altered at the White House. Joining us to talk about that and a whole lot more, our frequent guest on the show on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus hotline is Stephen Belton. He is the president and the CEO of the Urban League Twin Cities. Stephen, so thrilled to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thanks, Jordana. Good to be with you.
I'm troubled by this, and I'm glad we're talking about this because these executive orders, they get wordy, they get legalese, and I'm just a regular person, so it's hard for me to understand all of this. But this is an executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. And it looks to me, when I read it, that it stops any kind of diversity training for White House employees. Can this possibly be the way it actually is?
Well, first, kudos to you, Jordana, for getting through that very lengthy and wordy.
It's a lot. Yeah.
It is not an easy read. I'm a lawyer, and so I read these things with a fair amount of ease, but even by legal standards, it's a bit wordy and confusing. You asked whether or not it could actually have the effect and whether it's the intent to stop the White House staff from doing, or from government from doing, any kind of diversity training. Actually, the order is directed equally toward government contractors, so anybody who receives federal dollars, and that would include an organization like the Urban League, which has money from the federal government for its HUD housing programs, but a variety of, I guarantee you, nonprofits all over the country are taking a look at this, as well as private businesses that receive funding, because the executive order directs anybody who receives government funding that they have to, for the training that they provide their employees, they cannot have race-specific training in there. From my perspective, this is just sort of a thought police gone wild. This executive order actually attempts to direct what people can say and speak to each other. I guarantee you it will be challenged in court on First Amendment grounds of free speech. But more importantly, why is the federal government trying to tell people what to think about race? I don't know.
Stephen, I also, and thank you again for joining us today, as you do every Tuesday, and we are grateful for that. I also tried to wade through the executive order, and one paragraph, and I'm just going to read this real quick because it really stood out in my mind. It states, and I'm quoting, "Many people are pushing a different vision of America that is grounded in hierarchies based on collective social and political identities, rather than in the inherent and equal dignity of every person as an individual. This ideology is rooted in the pernicious false belief that America is an irredeemably racist and sexist country, that some people simply on account of their race or sex are oppressors, and that racial and sexual identities are more important than our common status as human beings, Americans. So is this basically the administration saying that there is no structural racism left anymore and we're all Americans? Get over it.
Yeah, so this is the White House, the president in particular, who are upset about something called critical race theory. And there's no way in your radio program or in a short snippet on my part to explain the fullness of critical race theory. But the basic idea of critical race theory is that society and culture should be examined through the lens of race and power and law, the intersection of race and power and law. And that there's this inherent idea in critical race theory that white supremacy and power is maintained over time. And so, but what you get in when you get into the nuance of critical idea is an idea that actually is at the opposite of what this executive order says. And that is that social structures, social, cultural structures are informed more by the operation of institutions than they are by individual choices and by psychological factors of individuals. So that says that the white supremacy that they are so critical of, the White House being so critical of, is really critical race theory says it's really the result more of institutional practices, of cultural assumptions, and less about what individual behavior is. And yet this executive order, this screwy executive order from my perspective, attempts to address individual behaviors, individual thoughts and ideas. This is just political grandstanding. It will have little or no impact other than to make a few government contractors sort of wary about the training that they offer to their employees. Keep in mind, you can be a training institution and a training contractor for the government, and it doesn't prohibit the training that you offer to others. It just says that you can't give your share these ideas based on critical race theory with your own employees. And I think that's just an overreach on the part of the current administration.
Stephen, and I know you explained that you don't necessarily have time to go into all of this on our show, but I've had people say to me that there is no systemic racism in this country.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And I'm just a regular person, so it's hard. I mean, I can give examples that I've seen in my life. I can bring up George Floyd and Jamar Clark and all sorts of other stuff. What is your response to that?
I'd say that you're missing the point of this, so the first reaction usually to the idea of institutional racism or even of white supremacy is to become defensive, to make it personal and to say, I'm not a racist or I have never observed these things personally. Well, I say, get over it. It's not about you. Yes, there is a component of your own complicity. You need to examine that and work on that, but that's not what this issue is all about. The fact is, when you factor in race for all of the disparities that are existing out here, when you equalize them, and take an example, perfect example would be on income. When you factor, as an example, education for across the board for African Americans versus whites, and you say each of them has a PhD or a certain number of years of postgraduate education, each of them has these certain opportunities, you will still find that the income of the black PhD or the black MBA or the black lawyer will lag behind that of whites. The reason for that cannot be attributed. Sociological studies, this is not my opinion, will show that it cannot be attributed to simply to their own initiative, their own intelligence. There's something else at work. That pernicious something at work is institutional racism. It is in the data. If you are a person who believes in science, believes in data, the studies are there. They are incontrovertible. What is resisting is people's personalization of the issue, and people want to say, well, I'm not racist, and I don't see it, and it doesn't account for my success or for the people that I know about, and therefore I'm going to deny it because I don't see it or because I don't believe it. And I say again, get over it. You need to move beyond yourself take a look at the data, and then get back it up and start looking at your own behavior and what your complicity in that may have been.
Steve,
a lot of
last
people
question.
Are simply taking advantage, are beneficiaries of racism. They aren't necessarily practitioners of it, but they are beneficiaries of it. Until they are willing to acknowledge it, then we're not going to be able to move forward in these discussions.
Wow.
So
thank
some
you.
People, hey, I'm not a racist, but maybe I will tolerate racism in others or look the other way. And by doing that, you're still complicit, right?
Yep, absolutely. There is not an option to look the other way. Nobody could look the other way when they witness what happened to George Floyd. And for you to witness that and to simply say, well, that's a terrible one-off kind of an incident, or to revert back to the bad apple scenario, when this bad apple scenario keeps happening again and again and again, it'd be one thing if it was just one George Floyd or two or three or if it just happened in 1 year. But this has been happening in this country for 200 years or more, and it keeps happening over and over. There will be another George Floyd. There will be another Ahmaud Arbery and another Breonna Taylor again and again. You can't deny that. And if you're a person of conscience, a person of faith, you need to take ownership of it and take some responsibility for it and to move forward.
Thank you for giving us that verbiage, because I think sometimes people just don't know how to respond to that. And I think that was really good guidance that, you know, you need to take yourself out of it. No one's calling you a racist. We're just benefiting from a racist society. And those examples you gave are very, very helpful. Stephen Belton, we appreciate you and we value your time here. So thank you for coming on the show.
Well,
thank you, Stephen,
for keeping on inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks again, both of you.
Oh, boy. Lots to unpack.
I always need like a break. After we talked to Stephen, I always need like, okay, I need to just digest all of that. I was like taking notes. I need to just kind of sit with all of that for a minute. I know it rolls off his tongue because this is what he does and sees it every day and educates about it. But wow, just glad we have access to him.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. Our thanks to Stephen Belton for coming on with us. In spite of Jordana, I'm amazed he keeps saying yes. When we come back, Kenny Blumenfeld is in charge of the Minnesota DNR. He is the senior climatologist, and he's going to connect the dots. The fact that we may see some snow over the weekend up north and a freeze, it's coming a little bit earlier than usual. Does that mean a rough winter ahead? Stick around. Paul and Jordana, hope your Tuesday is going well. It is the 13th day of October, 434. On News Talk 830 WCCO. It's been a pretty good year for corn farmers. Granted, there were some exceptions. There were a few reports of hail damage. We had a couple of small twisters out there. But corn maturity, 98% of all acres in Minnesota last week. That's 20 days ahead of last year and 12 days ahead of the five-year average. This, according to the USDA. So again, compared to last year when it wouldn't stop raining, devastating blow for farmers. It sure seems like this year was better. Kenny Blumenfeld is joining us right now from the Minnesota DNR. He is the senior climatologist, and it's always great to have him joining us on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus hotline with some of the stuff that makes him do a double take. Kenny, welcome back to the show.
Always good to talk to you, Paul.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. So I teased the whole notion of a freeze and flurries and maybe a little slush up north by Sunday night, Monday morning. And a lot of people are saying, oh, boy, here we go. It's going to be a brutal winter. But what happens in autumn, correct me if I'm wrong, does not necessarily portend a brutal winter. What does the data show?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, we looked at what happens when you get a snowy October. You know, about a quarter of the time or so, a little more than a quarter of the time, we get measurable snow, you know, a tenth of an inch or more during October at some point in the Twin Cities. And so the question is, all right, those years when you get measurable snow in October, what does it really mean for the rest of winter? And what we found was it doesn't mean much at all. If you look at the period that follows that, the remainder of winter, You get pretty much everything from dry to wet to, you might have some that were snowy, you have some that are cold, you have some that are warm, you have some that are just right on the button average. And we even expanded it into November. And when you look at the snowiest kind of autumn periods through the end of November, they are also, if you look at the remainder of winter, it's kind of all over the place. Anything from really snowy and cold, kind of how you'd expect, to some that were almost snowless and very warm. And Paul, of course, you remember the great autumn of 1991 following the Halloween blizzard. And then we had another big one right after Thanksgiving. And we were on pace for all-time records for snowfall. And then winter really kind of ended. And we didn't have much, and we had ended up with one of the warmest December through February's on record. So it really, you don't learn much from whatever happens in October.
Okay.
Kenny, it's Jordana. What about learning anything from the previous seasons? We've had an amazing spring. We've had an incredible summer. Does that bear anything for the upcoming winter? We've just been so lucky.
Well, I mean, I should mention, I'm not a professional seasonal forecaster, but, you know, one of the things that the sort of science of the larger climate in general has told us is that there's usually a pretty good transition as you go from the summertime pattern into the wintertime pattern, because the sunlight is doing completely different things. And so the energy associated with the winds aloft is in a different configuration with different speed and different kind of mechanisms working for it. So it's really common for there to be a decisive shift. If you are in a really wet pattern in the summertime, often you'll find it break into a duller pattern in the winter, and then vice versa. You rarely see a true carryover of the exact same pattern from winter into summer, or from summer into winter. And that's kind of what we've learned over the last several decades looking at this stuff.
Yeah, that's what's uniquely frustrating. Every storm is different. Every pattern is different. Every year is different. Kenny, I'm just curious. NOAA says that there's an 85% chance La Nina, the cool phase of the Pacific, is going to spill over into the entire winter. In the past, some winters, La Nina winters, turned out to be snowier than average here in Minnesota and across the upper Midwest. Does the DNR show any kind of a correlation with La Nina and the winters to come?
Well, I'll say this, Paul, that the way we've looked at it, and we've used some of our partners' resources that come from, say, the Midwest Regional Climate Center. And what we see when we look at how different El Nino and La Nina winters shape up in Minnesota, we see a much stronger connection between El Nino and, say, really warm, somewhat mild, and maybe dryish winters. Right. Than we do for La Nina. There, it seems like early in the record keeping, we had a few really brutal, long, cold, snowy winters, and that kind of drove the sense that when we get a La Nina, that we're going to have a long, cold, snowy winter here. But there have been some notable exceptions even in the last decade, and that has changed the statistics such that right now the only month that kind of stands out as being cold is February. And the other months, even if you take it from November into April, there's no real smoking gun for cold and snowy conditions during a La Nina. I would call it more of a tendency, you know, slightly. So it's not 50-50 chances. It tilts a little more towards cooler and snowier, but it's certainly not every time around. And you know, I often remind people that we were expected to have a cold, snowy winter going into 2011 and 12, and we ended up destroying records from November through March. That was the warmest November through March on record, and we were in a snow drought, and it was a strong La Nina. So, think it's hard. You know, you think weather forecasting is hard. I think that seasonal forecasting is really hard because your seasonal forecast can be made or broken by, you know, the presence or the absence of just a few well-timed storms. So it's a kind of precarious forecasting situation.
Well, Kenny, let's look back on Sunday's rain. That was some storm. Did it break the drought?
Oh, no, that I think what it did is it slowed down progress of the drought. I'm sure most listeners know we've had dry conditions creeping into Minnesota, and some areas that have now made it into the moderate drought category. And if you look in far, far, far southwest Minnesota, we even have a little bit of severe drought. And what the rain did, which really covered most of the state, but especially hit about the eastern half to two-thirds, is because it's fall, because we have, you know, less evaporation, because the sunlight is weaker, the days are shorter, that rain is going to stay in the ground a bit longer, and it's slowing down the spread of the drought. But it wasn't enough, and there weren't enough of them. We need a few more of these to really turn the whole drought situation around. So I think of this as kind of pausing it and buying us some time. So it probably bought us a couple weeks anyway before the situation could escalate again.
Kenny, 30 seconds left. Anything else on your mind? Anything that made you do a double take or a triple take? Anything you're excited about or dreading?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the year in general, I'd say that one of the biggest stories of the year is that, tragically, we broke our sort of drought of major tornadoes that we had been in, and we ended up getting a big one in July. So that's kind of the thing right now for the year that has stood out. I mean, it's nice that we shifted from really wet to at least closer to normal, if not a little bit dry. But the other big thing being that large tornado in central Minnesota, I think it was July 8th. Yeah.
And a sunnier, windier summer season. I can't remember this number of amazing sunny days. So thank God for big favors here. At least the weather has been relatively good here this year. Kenny Blumenfeld, senior climatologist at the Minnesota DNR. We are so happy. I know you're the senior climatologist, but you also wear a lot of hats over there. And thank you for all you do and your staff. And we'll get you back here often. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Paul. Always good to talk to you guys.
You bet.
And we'll get an update on Dalvin Cook from Mike Max. That's next on CCO.
Paul and Jordana, Dan Cook producing today. He's thrilled about that.
Yeah,
just cannot stop smiling.
Tweeting about it, texting his friends.
More of a grimace than a smile, but we are happy to have Dan along for the ride. Show you what a screwed up year it is. The Bills are playing the Titans this evening. There's an NFL game on a Tuesday night, got postponed because of COVID-19. All those Titans players and staff testing positive. So, boy, I don't know if you call that a silver lining. But coming up, I'm curious what Mike Max has in terms of updates on Dalvin Cook. Mikey, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me back. Yeah, we won't find out anything today because it's the Vikings' day off. So they literally almost closed down the facility. The players don't participate. There's no practice today. It's just the players' game plan for this week. Then tomorrow we should get an update when they return to practice. And they won't tell us much about Dalvin Cook, although we'll be able to at least shoot video the first part of practice to see if he's out there participating with them. And that's kind of a Wednesday tradition. All the photographers go out there and they say, okay, who's practicing and who's not practicing? And once in a while, you're surprised by what you see. Not often,
so what
but
does that
once
mean
in a while.
As the Vikings host the Falcons this Sunday, which we'd be looking for?
I don't think it'll matter much if he's there. I mean, they really want and they love him. But Alexander Mattison's a really good backup running back, and the Falcons are struggling. They just changed coaches, which you don't see that often this early in the year. They changed general managers, so they're in disarray. They haven't won a football game. So if they do or don't win on Sunday, or if they don't win, it shouldn't be because of the absence of Dalvin Cook if he doesn't play. In other words, they should have enough to beat the Falcons, even though, they've only got one win, so it's not like the Vikings are, a juggernaut here. They should be able to move the football on the Falcons. They should be able to score a lot of points on the Falcons with or without Dalvin Cook.
Maxie, I went to one of the most amazing tailgate parties I've ever been to, and it was for a Gophers game last year when they played Penn State. Fans could not have been nicer. The food was amazing. The beverages, the adult beverages, were amazing as well. I don't know the answer to this. I mean, a lot of buzz about possibly College Game Day on ESPN coming to town for the Gophers-Michigan game. Obviously, no fans in the stands, but can fans even tailgate now?
I guess you can. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it, but the game day is physically, you know, in a stadium sitting up on a perch because they don't want to get involved in creating any kind of, they want to be socially responsible. So they're not going to, you know, play to the crowd, so to speak, which is, you know, I mean, game day without a crowd isn't exactly game day anymore. You know what I mean? Yeah. That is the game day to an extent. Not that they don't have great analysts and all that and stories and all those things. But I guess I hadn't thought about that. But there's no restrictions or rules outside to a parking lot that I know of. So if you wanted to, you could. You know, you could do some things that way. I hadn't thought about that, but I'm sure you could, and I'm sure some will. And then they can watch the game right out there, I guess, if they want. You know, but that's a night game too. So you'd you'd be asking people, you know, if you did it in conjunction with game day, you wouldn't, you know, you'd be there very early, and then you'd have to wait about 8 hours before the kickoff because it said 6:30. But I guess you could do something. Plus, you have no students, of course. They're doing distant learning to a large extent, so you don't have the same student base. So, but yes, I'm sure you could tailgate and find a way to get a big screen or something like that if you wanted to have that communal feel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mikey, do you have any idea how good the Gophers are going to be this year?
Good.
Or maybe?
I mean, you know, we've spent so much time trying to figure out if they're going to play that you almost forget to look at how good they are. Now, here's what's different, Jordan and Paul, is they didn't play any non-conference games. So normally when they start the Big Ten season, you've got a pretty good idea of where these teams are at, or at least some weaknesses or strengths. This year you don't have quite that much. Now, here's what favors the Gophers. Tanner Morgan's a veteran quarterback, and he doesn't make many mistakes. In fact, he's uncanny in how he manages a game. That's a huge advantage coming into a season where you don't have time to experiment that much, because he has a presence and an intellect about him. And then he got Rashad Bateman back as a wide receiver to work with. Now, here's the X factor that we don't know, though, and we probably won't know until kickoff for both teams: the COVID effect. It's not just if you have COVID or not. It's if you've been exposed to it. There's all kinds of different rules and restrictions as to what forces a quarantine for a college football player. So we have no idea right now. The Gophers really probably don't have any idea, because they keep testing how many players could be affected by that. Like I said, it's not just if you test positive for COVID-19, it's if you've been in presence with a roommate, all those things. And we won't know, because we don't have access to any practice, until they run out on the field. But, you know, I've heard the Gophers have had a lot of players that not practiced several times this year. And it doesn't mean they tested positive. It just means that under the criteria, there's a protocol that follows. And if they were in the area of, they got to sit out, and that's true for all Big Ten teams. So we're not quite sure who's going to be playing the night of the game, and I think that's probably the mystery this year.
Oh, boy. Hey, Max, you're just curious. I have not heard of any major cancellations with high school football. It's been what? It's been 1 week.
There have been a couple major cancellations. The big one last week was Lakeville North against Rosemont. Rosemont had to cancel because they had a COVID problem. And I'll be darned if Crete and Durham Hall didn't need an opponent. They called Lakeville North, and voila, they played a game on Saturday afternoon. And they weren't even preparing for all week. They were preparing for other teams. Jeez. But they just did it. This week, Chanhassen was to play Chaska. Chanhassen played really well, put up 42 points last week against Jefferson. Chaska won as well, and they're the defending state champs, and obviously it's a border battle. And they had to cancel that one because of Chanhassen. So Armstrong was looking for a game, so they're going to go play at Chaska this week. So they've missed on some things, but these coaches and everybody's becoming so adaptable at this and so anticipatory that these things are going to happen that they're able to move the wheel pretty quick. And it's actually kind of impressive and interesting to watch.
Are you watching the kids on the sidelines? What's the social distancing like there?
I haven't. I'm trying to think of what I've seen. And I was at a game on Friday. I was out in Minneapolis watching Henry against South. Now, here was the interesting thing. There wasn't social distancing, but behind them on the track, they had water bottles and Gatorade. Everybody had their own individual bottle, and they had them all separated by about 10 feet. So you had a place with your number on it. You'd go back so there could be no confusion about getting the wrong water bottle or anything else, and they had those spread out completely along the track.
Good for them.
Hey, Maxie, I got a personal question. Is
oh boy.
Yeah, how much time?
He has a rash.
That too. Is it Chanhassen?
Yeah.
Or Chanhassen or Chan happening?
Chanhassen. Chanhassen. Chanhassen, right? Yeah.
Mikey, I'm sorry.
Chan Hassan? Oh.
Is that Mikey's phone?
No, I don't know what that was, and it's I don't think that Mike would ever accidentally forget to put it on silent mode. He wouldn't do that. He knows better than that because he's been around long enough.
Chan happening.
Chan happening. Chan happening this week, brother.
Yep. Thanks, Maxie. You're the best.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
You're a lunatic.
Well, I just think the things I should only. Yeah, I say the things I should. I think, which
maybe
is
like
not
a
good.
Little editing would be good. All right. Yeah. We're out. We will be back with our top stories on CCO in just a few moments after the news.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.